I'm an alcoholic. My name is Jaime. Thanks very much for having me speak here, North Oakland speaker. I was just at a meeting with one of the starters of this meeting, Brian H. We have this Sober in the 90s group that meets Saturday. It's just a Zoom meeting with people that got sober in the 90s. And I got in on the tail end of that one. So 15 March 1998 is my sobriety date. And it's always interesting to get sit in a bunch of room with a bunch of people that have 30 years of sobriety. And, you know, yet we still have alcoholism, not alcoholism. The ism, the I self me, the I sponsor myself, the I seek more. These are the things that we suffer from, you know, the, oh yeah, I can handle this. You know, I have a sponsor, his name's Robert C. I guess this year he's going to have 39 years. He got sober when he was 18. So that's pretty fabulous to know that, that my sponsor's been around, and him and I and a bunch of others, my grand sponsor, has got actually less, well, no, he's got a little more time than Robert. He just turned 39 as well. So it's interesting to know that I'm still amongst a group of people that still do this on the daily. I went to an 8 a.m. meeting this morning, the usual morning I go to too early in San Francisco. It's a big book study. And then I met with a sponsee and we read more about alcoholism, the whole chapter, and he was very, very interested in it. He's got maybe 7 days now. So to work with somebody with 7 days of sobriety, I mean, that's something else, you know, because for the newcomer, if anybody's got that much time or a little more, I mean, that's basically what we're here to do, is to learn how to work with other people. Do the steps, work with others. And I've been doing it a lot over the past 23 years. It's quite a journey. It's quite a journey. It's quite an experience to get your first fifth step out, your first fourth step written, and your first fifth step told to another alcoholic, and then to be on the receiving end of that. And I guess I'm kind of old-fashioned because I'm good for the long haul on those. You know, I've sat on six-hour fifth steps, and that'll do something to you. And what we used to do was burn the fourth step afterwards, you know, to get it out of the way. It's done. So that was like a ritual that I used to do, and that was very interesting. I haven't done that in a while, so maybe I'll get a chance to do it with this guy, although this guy is actually in Virginia. So now in the age of Zoom, we're sponsoring, you know, over phone. It's a little strange. I don't necessarily think, I mean, if we go back to regular face-to-face meetings, I'd probably suggest that he get a sponsor there. But for now, it works. And I think it's just another bridge that we're crossing here in Alcoholics Anonymous. So here we are. The pandemic has prepared me completely. Well, actually, Alcoholics Anonymous has prepared me completely for this pandemic. I mean, in more often than not, I'm not worried about not being in face-to-face meetings. You know, that may just be a product of age or whatever. Been there, done that, I guess. But there's a whole generation now of people that got sober only in Zoom meetings. So how's that for when we go back to face-to-face and they're going to be sitting there wondering what's going on? And, you know, we're going to be asking them to get commitments and whatnot and be greeters. And that's going to be pretty fun. That was my opportunity at the very first meeting. So the person who was the secretary of this meeting that I went to at 6 p.m. tonight, not this meeting in particular, but and the speaker, 23 years ago, the secretary that is now was the outgoing secretary and the speaker, the outgoing secretary of the meeting now, she was the incoming secretary. So the roles reversed 23 years later. So there I was, you know, and so much has changed. You know, it's like, I think it's in Bill's story where it says, everything had changed, yet nothing had changed. You know, I'm still this person. I'm still this alcoholic, but I'm not drinking anymore. And I've done the steps and I've had a spiritual awakening and I'm able to help other people. And my life is oh so much better. You know, I have no, long time ago, there was a speaker that said, some of you might know him, his name is Lord here in the city. He was speaking early on and I wasn't so wowed by him, but it was something that he said that interested me. And he said, my disease is outside doing push-ups and, you know, it's getting stronger, you know, lest I forget. And at the time I was just all, you know, that's a novel concept, you know? And in the end, I was a little bit perturbed. Like I used to really get perturbed at people who would say, I'm sick. I'm still sick. I've been sober this long, but I'm sick. I'm sick in the head, you know, stuff like that. And I'd just be like, man, fuck this. I don't want to hear all that. But now, all these years later, I understand. I understand. We're sick people trying to get better. You know, the real miracle in AA, I think, for me, is that we're all not sick at the same time. You know, exactly the way, you know, it's not like we have a room full of people that are really down and out. You know, some are okay, some are not. You know, the okay people will help out the some of the not people, and then maybe, just maybe, the roles will reverse, because you never know. You never know when you're going to have a bright idea and you might be on your way to a relapse, and the guy from the meeting or the girl from the meeting that you're just like, I can't stand that person, they're going to be the one person that's there to help you out. I mean, hopefully you'll have a connection with something bigger than yourself and you won't go down that route. But, you know, you can't call that shot. You cannot call that shot. So it's pretty important to show up to a meeting and to try to greet people. I mean, in the age of Zoom, it's just very, very strange for me, you know, because I come in and I immediately, I get too happy for the moment. So I like to come in at the end. Because if I see somebody I haven't seen in a while, you know, it's just really strange. But, you know, in live meetings, it's good to mix it up. It's good to shake hands. It's good to see people and to actually sit down next to somebody and say, so how are you doing today? And you'd be surprised. Somebody said to me, welcome. We're glad you're here. When I was early on in sobriety, and I was just all, you're glad I'm here. You know, you don't know who you're talking to. But, you know, again, years later, I realized, yeah, we're glad you're here. We're glad you're here, you know, allowing us to hold up the standard. Because for me, Alcoholics Anonymous, thank you. Alcoholics Anonymous is a sacred thing. It's not a game. It's life and death. You know, we're actually here to help each other and pull each other back from the gates of insanity or death. Because if you're a real alcoholic and you drink again, you may die. I may have another relapse in me, but I doubt that I got another recovery in me. And that scares the fucking living hell out of me. So all these years later, you know, I'm waking up, I'm praying, I'm meditating, I'm going to a meeting, I'm meeting with somebody, I'm going to another meeting. I answer the phone when it rings, and I say yes when they ask me at the last minute to speak for 10 minutes. And here I am. And hopefully I will never forget. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Shannon. I'm an alcoholic. Wow, it's really an honor to be here with you guys this evening. I've never been asked to share for this long of a period of time. So it was funny because the person that asked me to share, I my first like gut reaction was to say no. And then I thought, you know what? It's actually kind of perfect that it's last minute, you know? And I, did I even introduce myself? Hi, I'm Shannon. I'm an alcoholic. Sorry.
Yeah.
See, I'm already like, all of a sudden I'm like nervous now that I'm talking, but, I still went on like my regular Saturday night meeting, which is, I've been going to, the Rock Ridge Fellowship at 5:30. Cause I thought, well, maybe I should like take some time and like write out an outline. And, you know, I started to like overthink it a little bit. I'm like, you know what? I feel so like peaceful inside. I'm just going to like go with it. And I know that, God will speak through me because of myself, I am nothing. Like, so I just totally trust that like my higher power is like gut is running the show right now. And, at 7:50, I just like lit a candle and I prayed and I just said, let me be of service this evening. And, let me reach out to anybody that's suffering in the rooms. And, I haven't suffered in the rooms in a really long time. You know, it's like, I struggle, of course, I'm a human being. And that's what human existence is all about, is like the struggle is real, right? All right. So I'll give you a little story. Just kind of go over my life a little bit. My sobriety date is May 22nd, 2002. So, I'll have, is that 19 years next month? Which, you know, it doesn't really matter. And it's kind of funny, like the longer I stay sober, like, yeah, I like to honor my birthday and everything like that. But it's almost like the more time I have, the more I realize like those cliches that we hear and they become like ingrained in us. Like it really is one day at a time, like 1 minute at a time, 1 hour at a time, especially this past year. I've had one of the hardest years of my life, and I'll get to that in a little bit. But I was born in the Bay Area. My family's from Alameda, and I was the firstborn to my father, and I have two younger sisters and an older sister with the same mom. So there's four of us, and my biological father raised my older sister, and I didn't grow up in an alcoholic household, but I know that I was born with the genetic makeup. Like I know that like my DNA, I'm an alcoholic. It runs rampant on my father's side of the family, which is like Irish Catholic. And my grandfather, at 8 years old, saw my grandfather in the hospital die of this disease at 59 years old. And, but no one in the family said that like he died of alcoholism, but as a little kid, I knew that that's what had happened to him. And, so, you know, once I got sober and started learning about the disease of alcoholism, I of course realized that I, even though I didn't grow up with, active drinking in my household, my dad was an alcoholic. He had every single behavior of an alcoholic, but he just didn't drink like one. And my parents actually didn't really drink that much. My mom, I was raised Mormon, LDS. So my mom actually didn't consume alcohol until all my sisters and I were out of the house. And now she drinks like a bottle of wine a day. So I don't know if that's an alcoholic or not, but her current husband is definitely an alcoholic. And that's here nor there. What's interesting about my family lineage though, is, all four of us are alcoholics. So my older sister and then me and my two younger sisters, we all have the disease of alcoholism, and, myself and my baby sister are, sober. My, younger sister chooses not to do AA. She did AA for a while, and, but I have found a life. I just can't even imagine doing sobriety or recovery or life without AA. AA has always been like just a huge part of my life. And I'm so grateful. Let's see. So, as my mom began to have more kids, we kind of moved out of the city, and we ended up in San Ramon for about 10 years. And that's where I went to grammar school and intermediate school. And then in 1984, my dad got a transfer, and we moved up to this country town called Sonora, California. And it was funny because I was leaving the Bay Area, and I had grown up, you know, in the city and then suburbia. And all my people were like, "You're moving to Sonoma? Sonoma?" Like, everyone thought I was moving to Sonoma. And I was like, "No, Sonora." And so for those of you that don't know, Sonora is actually in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada. So if you, it's basically like 2.5 hours, like directly east of San Francisco. And it's really beautiful. It's really close to Yosemite. And it ended up being, I would say, like a life, what I would say, like if I had to name like five things in my biography that were like life-changing, moving to Tuolumne County was like first on the list. And then I would have to say that like second is like getting sober. It was a huge, huge, huge gift because I got to have this like experience that was just so different. Like, of course I had that like huge problem from that I can trace back to as long as I can remember, that I like didn't like myself. I had a very, very low like self-esteem. And I had, you know, I had a couple friends, and I got bullied in school a little bit. That year that my family moved up to Tuolumne County, I had two best friends, and one of them moved to Utah, and I moved to Sonora, and the other one stayed in San Ramon. And so we all kind of went our separate ways. But as I was becoming a teenager, like those feelings of inadequacy and soul sickness and self-loathing and like anxiety just really started to like rear their ugly heads. But Sonora was just so different than the Bay Area. And I instantly, well, it took me a couple of months, but I found this incredible group of friends that to this day I'm still friends with, like most of them. One of my really good guy friends, he was just here from Bend, Oregon. And we had a really great visit. And there's like a handful of us that we stay in touch, and we talk and we see each other. And it was such an incredible gift, you know? And, so high school ended up being like a really good experience for me. I felt a little more comfortable in my own skin in this kind of smaller town environment. The kids were just nicer. Like, I don't know, like suburbia kids were just a bunch of like rich brats or something. I don't know. And I was probably one of them, but I didn't, you know, I didn't fit in there. I didn't fit in anywhere. Like, as you know, like, those kinds of things just may help for a little while, but, you know, and I was always a really good student. I played the flute from like fourth grade all the way through high school, when I was usually either first or second chair out of like 14 to 20 people. And, you know, I got really good grades, and, I was a cheerleader, and, I had this great group of friends, and I had all the makings for like a happy, teenage experience. But I always felt this deep sense that I was fatally flawed. And I actually am, I still like struggle with that today. And, it's just been my experience in like relationships to, get attached and, you know, and get triggered that way. So it's something I've had to work on like really hard in my sobriety. Let's see, the first time I ever tasted alcohol, I was 8 years old, or maybe a little bit younger, and I had a toothache, and my father soaked the cotton candy and like shoved it in my gum. And I remember that sensation, that warming sensation that comes over your body. And I can still remember to this day, like, how good that felt. I'm actually surprised that I didn't, like, drink again until I was almost 16. I mean, we didn't have booze in the house, so maybe I would have. Who knows? But so that was like the first time I ever tasted alcohol. And then the first time and every time after the first time I drank, I got drunk. And I drank an entire bottle of champagne. And then the second time I got drunk, I drank rum and cokes and I got like violently ill. And I blacked out. And somehow my friends like got me home and got me into bed. And like my parents didn't even know or anything. And that was pretty crazy. But yeah, so I graduated from high school and I ended up taking, I went to junior college for a year and then I worked as a nanny for a year and a restaurant for a year after that. And then I went and traveled in Europe for 3 months with two girlfriends. And that was really fun. And then when I got back from there, I was just really lost. You know, I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life. And I ended up like moving to San Francisco and working down there and just drinking and partying in my 20s. And then I decided to go to culinary school. So I went to culinary school and I graduated from that. And then I, from 95 until 2004, I was a chef or a cook. You know, I worked at different restaurants. And I pretty much did almost like every position in a restaurant that you could do. And it was pretty fun. Being a chef and a cook or a cook and working in restaurants is like the perfect job for an alcoholic. You had like free access to alcohol like all the time, right? And I think by the time I was about 22 or 23, I knew I was an alcoholic. I guess in a way, like I was already like admitting it to my innermost self, but definitely by the time I was like 27 or 28, I knew my drinking was really different than everybody else I was around. I ended up like moving back up to Tuolumne County after culinary school. And I think, yeah, I was with a guy that lived up here. That's right. I'm in Sonora actually right now. I moved back here last May. And so I kind of moved back up here because of him and we were together for a while. And then, let's see, what was my point of saying that? Oh, whatever. I guess then I ended up, moving back to the Bay Area when that relationship didn't work out. And, I don't know. It was that time in my life, like, you know, all my friends from like high school and everyone had graduated from college and people were getting married. And then one of my best friends was, you know, having babies. And here I am approaching like 28 years old. And like, I knew I was like, my number one problem was that like, I was an alcoholic. And it was around that time that I met my future husband. And, we moved to Santa Cruz together and, I still remember the day, like he asked me to marry him and I was such a bad alcoholic and it was 1999. And, he asked me to marry him and I, in my innermost self, I was like, I shouldn't marry him because I'm an alcoholic. Oh wait, no, I should marry him because I'm an alcoholic. And so we got married in, September of 2000. And it's kind of interesting how, like, when I look back, I haven't thought about, like, the progression of my alcoholism for a while. So it was definitely, like, having fun and partying, and everyone was pretty much kind of on the same page. And when you're, I don't know, for me, I didn't like really start getting hungover and like having really bad hangovers. So I was in my late 20s, and no one like ever really said anything to me or anything like that. But I just knew in myself, like I did not drink like anybody else, you know? And, when I got married, I was just very, very sick. I weighed like 220 pounds. I was really overweight. I was really just soul sick, you know? And, we lived in Oakland when we got married, and, my husband had graduated from Santa Cruz. So then we moved up to Oakland, and, right after we got married, and then he got a job with Caltrans. And so that was like what he got his degree in. And he's an archaeologist. So we moved, he got a job in Fresno. And so we moved out to the Valley to a town called Merced. I didn't want to live in Fresno. I thought, well, Merced was good because he could work in Fresno. And I had a part-time job up in Sonora. I was actually Jamestown, which was like a 45-minute drive from my house at the time, because it wasn't all the way in Sonora, but and it was just part-time. And it was with a friend. And so, and even though my drinking was so bad, somehow I was able to still kind of hold down a job. So in February of 2002, I was just starting to black out like every day, like all the time. And I was like, I was going shopping in blackouts and I was doing all these crazy things. And, I was going up to Oakland all the time because I still had lots of friends up there. And, so I was driving a lot between like Oakland and Merced, like on my days off. And, one time I was driving home, I mean, I deserved to get like thousands of DUIs, you know, and I took my life and your life into my hands, like every time I got behind the wheel. But, you know, by the grace of God, I didn't ever hurt anybody else or myself or get a DUI or anything like that. But I was driving home. I was up in Oakland and I got to Merced and I came to in the morning and I didn't know where I was, but I was at home in Merced and I was like, how the hell did I get home last night? And I just, you know, had my I don't know where my husband was, but I was like, oh my God. Okay. So I went out my kitchen door and I saw my Honda in the driveway parked like askew with the driver's door just like wide open. So somehow I had driven in a blackout. I made it home, passed out. And so I go out to like sit in my car. I'm with maybe getting the keys or something. And then like I was kind of sitting there just like, oh, holy shit, you know. I can't believe, you know, this is happening. And, but then I remembered I stopped and like got a bottle on the way home. So I, reached under my seat, good place to keep a bottle. I always kept it under the seat or in the glove box. And I had like almost a full pint of vodka. And like, I was so relieved. I was just like, oh, thank you. I didn't, you know, you think I'd be thinking like, oh, maybe it's time to get some help, you know? And I had another really scary incident that year in early 2002 where I had gone up to Oakland and I stopped at the liquor store by my house. It was probably like close to 2 a.m. And I met some guy in the parking lot there and he like offered me crack. And so I got in a car with a stranger at 2 a.m. on like a Friday night. And I was basically probably like really close to being in a blackout because I barely remember. But after I smoked the crack with him, it like woke me up and I was like, holy shit, like who are you? Where am I? Take me to my car. Like, what am I doing here? I kind of freaked out. And luckily he wasn't like an axe murderer and he was like, it's okay, it's okay. Like I'm blah blah blah. We met at the liquor store and I'm like, will you please just take me back to my car? And I guess my husband had come looking for me because he was expecting me home a few hours before. And he even like popped my trunk to see like if my body was in the car. And it was one of the first times he really like laid into me. You know, he was the perfect Al-Anon. Like he he was really sick too. I hate to say it. It's like, he should have never put up with the shit that I was pulling, you know? And, anyhow, so in February of that year, I decided I was going to get sober, and I lied about like going to AA, and I would like drive to an AA meeting and just like park, but never go in. And then a couple weeks later, I was drinking again. And he said to me, I know you're drinking again. And I was like, yeah, so what? Like, that's what I do. And in late April of 2002, I finally said to him, I need help. I didn't know what that meant. I just was like, that's all I said. And so I got into a rehab place in in Modesto called New Hope. And I was doing an outpatient program, which was kind of a joke because I just wasn't that bad. And then I ended up drinking again Mother's Day weekend. And then if you get caught drinking, then you have to either go inpatient or get kicked out. And so I remember Ben, my husband, was like so irritated with me that I drank again. And it's just like, well, so I chose to do the inpatient program. And that was on May 21st, 2002. And so the next day is my sobriety date. And I've had continuous sobriety since then. And what was different about May 21st and May 22nd is acceptance. And that's always like my topic when I share. And I want to read this part in the big book because it's my fave. And acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. When I am disturbed, it is because I find some person, place, thing, or situation, some fact of my life, unacceptable to me. And I can find no serenity until I accept that person, place, thing, or situation as being exactly the way it's supposed to be at this moment. Nothing, absolutely nothing, happens in God's world by mistake. Until I could accept my alcoholism, I could not stay sober. Unless I accept life completely on life's terms, I cannot be happy. I need to concentrate not so much on what needs to be changed in the world, is on what needs to be changed in me and in my attitudes. And there was something that day we were doing a women's group in rehab, and I loved the women's group. There was this really amazing woman named Anita there, and she was super spiritual. She was empathic, and she wouldn't even be able to like hold hands in the group because she could read us. You know, she was amazing. She was this Native American woman, and we would talk about cooking. She was like this amazing cook. And I begged her one time to make us carnitas. And she's like, okay, I'll make you guys carnitas, because the food in rehab is terrible. It's like grilled cheese and just garbage. And we had this like taco feed. And anyway, that day we were doing this, these runes, which are the runes are the Nordic alphabet, and there's the beautiful little drawings. They're tiles, and so you can draw one, and there's a book that goes with it, and they're really neat. And I drew the rune of acceptance, and it was my first like spiritual experience. And I was sitting in the group, and I was looking at the rune, and I had to read out loud like what my rune meant. And it was the first moment in like over 20 years where I had like a little bit of peace inside of me. And it was like a voice that was different than that alcoholic voice that I had become. And it said, you just have to accept the fact you're an alcoholic. And I was like, okay, I can do that. And it was just really incredible. And I remember, of course, in rehab, they take you to outside meetings. And so, of course, like I was going to AA and NA almost every day. And I had to get a sponsor before I left. And so I asked this woman, Elizabeth, to sponsor me in Merced. And I remember the day I got out of rehab, I went home And I was so full of fear still. I was just riddled with like self-loathing and fear. And I got home around 5 or so, like 4, and my meeting didn't start till 6. And I didn't know what to do with myself. Like, my husband wasn't there. Like, looking back on it now, I should have asked him to like meet me at home or like come pick me up or something. But I had my car in Modesto. So I just sat on my hands. I remember hearing that at a meeting, like, if you don't know what to do, just like sit on your hands and breathe. And so I did. And I just stared at my off television. You know, I didn't even turn the TV on. I couldn't move. Like, I didn't want to drink, but I had never been in that house sober. And like the last couple years of my drinking, like, I never drew a sober breath. And I was vomiting every morning, you know, and I was like 30 days sober. And I like didn't know what to do with myself, you know, but I must have prayed in that moment. And I see that. And the grace of God just entered me and just said, just sit tight, you know. And I went to my meeting, and it's like the magic just began to happen, you know. I didn't mean to spend so much time on my drunkalog, sorry, because like the gifts of AA are just like, I could talk about that all night long, you know. And I think that the most important thing are the people in the rooms. I get my strength from your strength. I get my hope from your hope. I get my faith from your faith. You guys show me how to do it, you know. I had this incredible sponsor named Harriet that took me through the steps for the first time. And I'll never forget the moment we had. Like, I got on my knees. I got on my knees and I was like, holy shit, like, I'm down on my knees, you know. And I didn't like it because it made me feel religious. And I'd been raised Mormon, and Mormon, that doctrine is pretty like fucked up, if you ask me. And it took me about 9 years to say the word God, you know, and everything like I did in my life that I've done in my life up to this point is like literally like with the network of like AA, like the principles of the program and the people in the program and my sponsors and my sponsees and my friends and my, you know, like everybody, has held me up, you know. And in 2003, we bought a house in Sonora, and so we moved back here. And then I had my daughter, Fiona, in 2004, and my son Ezra in 2007. And it's like, AA taught me how to be a mom, you know. It was really, really hard, you know, but I am grateful that my children, you know, didn't ever have to see me drink. And this past year has been, you know, really intense. And I've been through a divorce and sobriety. I pulled a lot of geographics, but one thing that was good is I stayed. My children went to the same school for 8 years. They went to a Waldorf school. So if anyone's familiar with Waldorf education, it's a really beautiful education. It's spiritual. It's kind of, and it's very creative. It sort of has like aspects of like Buddhism, Christianity, and like paganism. And I was so grateful. Like, I found this Waldorf school, and I ended up doing the Waldorf teacher training. And that's kind of like, I moved into that second career once both my kids were in school, was teaching. And so that's what I do now. In fall of 2018, when my daughter Fiona was a freshman in high school, she got diagnosed with anorexia. And I knew that she just was kind of a picky eater and all of that. And then I just remember like, oh my God, like maybe you have an eating disorder. And she was kind of mad at me. She thought like, you know, that I took it lightly and whatnot. And I didn't. So we finally got her help and realized that she was very, very sick, and she was tachycardic for about 3 months. And her pediatrician and her therapist were in Modesto, and I was living up here in Sonora. And so, and I'm in this Waldorf teacher training, and I'm going to the Bay Area every weekend for that. And basically, for about 4 years, I just felt like I was like living on adrenaline, you know, especially the last like three. And so she got better, and I felt like she was doing so much better, you know, and I accepted this teaching position at East Bay Waldorf School, and it was going to start in the fall of 2019. And so we made the big move to the Bay Area. Like, my children had grown up in this small town, and I had this opportunity for a house share in Kensington. So I took it, and Ezra was going to start seventh grade, and Fiona was a sophomore at El Cerrito High School. And around the first of the year of 2020, Fiona was just like struggling with depression really, really bad. And she had this group of friends, and I just couldn't figure out like what was wrong with her. You know, I felt like we had dealt with the anorexia and, you know, and all of that stuff. But as I learned later, that's just a very brutal, brutal, like, mental illness, you know. And she had relapsed in her anorexia probably in December, and we didn't find out until February. And so she was in and out of the psych ward. She was just like despondent, and she just told me, she's like, Mama, I don't want to get better. And it was just terrifying to me, you know. She was just gone, you know, spiritually. And then COVID hit, and I got in a car accident, and I had to move out of the Kensington house in February. And then, you know, of course, COVID hit in March. And so then I was laid off, and then I lost the school closed. And then finally we got Fiona into this rehab facility for girls with eating disorders. And she was only in there for 3 weeks. And I don't know if you guys know that much about anorexia, but it's very, very hard to overcome. And it's really, really hard to deal with as a parent. And so it was scary to me that they let her out, you know, like after 3 weeks. And so they released her on April 22nd, and she was only home for 3 days. And she went to her dad's that Friday night, and Saturday morning, April 25th of last year, she took her life. She jumped off of a footbridge onto the pavement in the town where her father lives. It's Lathrop. It's like out in the valley. And I was completely shocked, of course. I, in a million years, did not think that she would take her life. And so, needless to say, you know, after the dust settled a little bit, and since I wasn't working, and I have a big support system up here in Sonora, I decided to move back here last May. And so I've just been here with my son. He went back to his old class at the Waldorf School, and he's been able to go to school in person, which has been such a gift. And I found him a good like teen suicide support group with other kids his age that have lost a sibling or a parent to suicide. And it's on Zoom, but it's every other Monday for an hour and a half. And it's been, you know, a pretty unbearable thing, but somehow I'm bearing the unbearable. And I really know without a doubt that it is because of this program. I remember when I was 4 or 5 years sober, a woman that I just admired and looked up to, and she was always just a part of my recovery. She was never my sponsor or anything. She lost her grandson to this disease. I mean, she lost her grandson to suicide. He was 23 years old. And then 7 years later, she lost her daughter to this disease, who I went to high school with, who was a year older than me. And I watched her and her family walk through those losses in the rooms of AA. And I know without a doubt that that's why I was able to stay sober through it, because somebody that I knew so well, and they just continually shared their grief and their pain. And Sonora is a pretty kind of a small town, so the AA fellowship is really tight, you know, and that was such a blessing. In fact, she gave me this book, and it's called Healing After Loss. And it's really incredible. And I think I'm kind of running out of time, and I just want to end with this. Because I read this the other day, and it just reminded me of us. It reminded me of AA, you know, and yeah, you know, like every day of the journey is the journey. And I remember hearing that in a meeting when I first got sober. And that's also why I read that page in the Big Book about acceptance, because I totally believe that, you know, that nothing happens in God's world by mistake, you know, and I may never understand why Fiona took her life, you know, but I wanted to show you guys a picture. This is like one of my favorite little pictures of her. This is on her school, had this, she's making kind of a silly face, a May Day celebration. So that was like her little like eighth grade May Day photo. But, and my nickname for her was Sweet Pea. So I feel her close all the time. I have an altar for her here. And sometimes, like the other night, I came home and sat at it, and I just could almost feel her hands go like this, or she kind of like guided my hands like to my heart. And I just hear her all the time. That just gave me chills. I just hear her tell me, Mama, it's okay. Mama, it's okay. You know. Anyway, I'll read this. Be patient with everyone, but above all with yourself. I mean, do not be disturbed because of your imperfections, and always rise up bravely from a fall. I'm glad that you make daily a new beginning. There is no better means of progress in the spiritual life than to be continually beginning afresh. And that's Frances de Sales. One of the things that is so hard about recovering from grief is that it takes so long. And when we get discouraged, not only from the continuing presence of the grief, but because of our own inability to handle it better. Just when we think we are making progress, wham, it sweeps over us and seems new again. Nowhere more than here is it important to be patient with ourselves, not let ourselves be weighed down by the discouragements of yesterday. Each day is a new day, a fresh beginning. As I stand on the threshold of this day, I leave behind me the cares and anxieties of yesterday. So thank you for letting me be of service tonight.